the Saturday night of the retreat, the Saturday night, the satsang before the intensive, always a special time. So I want to welcome everybody to that. And I seem to remember I usually welcome you by some method, but I can't remember what it is. Oh, okay, thanks. I always remember my guru, Swami Muktananda, who always began every program by saying in Hindi, Sabko bade sammane ke saath prem se hridayik swagat. With great respect and love, I welcome you all my heart. And in that spirit, we conduct these programs, and he used to say that that's the essence of spirituality, to welcome another person with love. So I welcome you in that spirit. And it's a very wonderful time. Every time we do a retreat, it always gives great, you could say, rewards of the spirit, gifts of the spirit. But this one was very special. This was a training in Shiva process, in self-inquiry. And all I can say is it was intense. Was it intense or not?
Yeah.
Extremely intense. And you know, I'm from the old school of yoga. I like intense. And so it was very good. And we certified 35?
Yeah.
First level 35? Shiva process people. So now, that means that if you speak to them, they can read your mind. At the second level, they can enter your inner space. And the third level, they can change everything inside and then leave without you knowing it. So you be careful around here. So I also want to welcome everyone watching on the internet. And tonight we have all around Australia, Japan, Czech Republic, no India tonight, huh? Okay, very good. And I want to welcome my mustache, which is starting to rear its ugly head. It's in honor of Movember, and if you have the mustache growing capacity, you can join my posse on the, what is it, Shiva Mo? Mo Shiva. Mo Shiva. And you can see, who should I say, Shalvani? See Shalvani about that. You want to be in Mo Shiva.
And the girls joining?
I can. Yes. Can't we have any place of our own? I went to an Ivy League school, soon they let girls in there. And I joined a golf club, soon they let girls in there. But figure if it's a mustache growing club, then they can't have any girls in there. Well, there were a few in high school, actually. But we didn't notice it. Well, now behave. All right, so the intensive, of course, is the program which I hold because Baba Muktananda started it many, many years ago. Baba was the most prolific awakener. He gave Shaktipat awakening around the globe to thousands and thousands of people. He awakened their kundalini energy, their inner power. And when he went to the West, he developed the intensive format as a vehicle for that awakening. And he always told me, hold intensives, hold intensives, hold intensives. That was mainly the extent of our relationship after a while. And I'd say, well, don't you love me? Hold intensives. You know, like it was like that. Anyway, so I got the message he wanted me to hold intensives. So I've been doing that for a long time now. And so I consider this perfect service to my guru to hold these intensives. And so on the night before intensive, I always do my program, which I call Ganesh Puri Days, which is kind of a reminiscence of my time with Baba. I spent a number of years in the early 70s at his ashram in India. And it was an extraordinary and formative time because his ashram was all business. It was all growth, and it was a pressure cooker, and it was highly disciplined, highly structured, and you woke up early, 3:30 in the morning, the bell went off, and there were at least half the people were up already. And you'd meditate, chant, then you'd work around the ashram, and then you'd eat a meal, and then you'd chant some more, and work some more, and meditate some more, and tumble into bed after the last chant around 9 p.m., and then up early in the morning every day. And this routine went on and on and on. And Bhagwan Nityananda, Baba's guru, whose murti or statue is there, was a great, great soul. He died in 1961. And Baba had settled in his ashram a little bit up the road from there. And he sat there through the 60s. And he met people. A few people came in from Mumbai. And they would go to visit Bhagwan Nityananda's shrine, his Samadhi shrine, where he's buried. And they would go, and then they'd come up the road. And they heard there was a young Swami up the road who had a lot to offer, and they would go talk to him and have informal conversations. And it was very small. They didn't even have a kitchen in the ashram, and nobody could really stay there. Very few people were there, and Baba was planting the garden there and just sort of living there. Then in 1970, he got the inner call to travel to the West. And he traveled, first time in Australia was in 1970. And he did programs in Kew, I think, at that time, and various places in Australia. And he traveled to the U.S. and to Europe, but it was a very quick trip. And as fate had it, it turned out, and I found out later, that the day that I left America on my way to India, hearing the call of an unknown person, an unknown being. I knew I was going to meet my teacher in India. I didn't know who it was. And I just was driven to go. But on the very day that I left America, flying on my way to India, Baba had left India on his way on his first world tour. Remarkable coincidence, which I discovered later. But by the time I got to India, because I went overland, he was already back in India, because it took me several months. And so by the time I got there, he'd returned. I still hadn't heard of him. But then through a series of circumstances, by March of 71, I got to his ashram. And his ashram was just extraordinary, as I've described it. It was immaculately clean. It was on purpose. And it had a military discipline, and I saw immediately that it was a place for growth, transformation. And that's what I was on board for. I wanted transformation, and I wanted growth. And, you know, I wasn't wrong, it was that place. And when I got there, the Westerners started to come. Because of his first tour, he contacted a lot of people in the West, they started dribbling in. This was just a few months after that tour. And, you know, there might have been 100 people in the ashram at that time. About half were Westerners. And we were just thrown into this routine. And there was no explanation. You know, in the West, I didn't realize it until the manager of the ashram, who a lot of you know, he's Swami Govindananda, who visited here a couple of months ago and spent quite a bit of time. He's very beloved. He's now 83 or 4. Beloved occasional member of our satsang. But he was the manager of the ashram then. And he sort of was the agent of Baba's discipline. So he would discipline everybody and run around. And he's told me, he said, how come Westerners always go, why? Why? They want to know why. If I tell them something, they say, why? And he'd say, not why, just do. This was the philosophy there. And I realized that, you know, we want to have a full explanation. We want to understand what it's all about, what the philosophical meaning is, what the social meaning is, what the religious meaning is, what the, you know, the everything. We want to know everything about it before we do something. But in the this was a classical ashram. You didn't ask questions. You just did. You went, gee, Baba, and you did it. So that was the way it was when we got there. We just were thrown into this routine, and there were no explanations. There was nothing to read either. Baba hadn't published his books at that point. So there was just this thing going on day after day after day. And after a while, you know, it starts to get to you. And Baba looked at us and he said, they need a little bit of information. And so he took mercy, he had mercy on us, and we had question-answer sessions with him. And these, of course, were the highlight of my life when these happened. It was months later, after I got there, that he started these. And so we would go gather with him in his room, actually. It was that small. And he would answer our questions. And this was the highlight, and I would ponder every answer and I'd take everything personally. And I freaked myself out more times than I can remember by things he said. I knew he was always talking about me. Not the part where he said, you are Shiva. It was the part where he said, you're a worm, you're not doing enough, you're, you know, all these things. I knew that was about me. And I would be crushed and go out and I'd be crushed and I'd try to put it together. But anyway, these were fantastic sessions that we had. And later they were gathered. They were taped. They just had to begin. They had little cassette machines then, which everybody was quite, you know, entranced with. And so they started taping these things. And later they became a series of books called Satsang with Baba. And so I have been spending the last 20 years working through the 5 volumes of Satsang with Baba. And I've reached volume 5 and I'm well into it. And the end is in sight. Sometime in this millennium, you know, I'm going to reach the end of that. But I enjoy so much sharing the question answers and telling a little bit about the culture of a very extraordinary time in my life. A time when there are just a few people living very far away from civilization with no TV and no magazines, just totally focused on growth and in a kind of classical context, living with the master in this growth-inducing cauldron of change. So this is Question Answers with Baba Muktananda. Maestro? This is a picture. This is, looks very spaced out there, doesn't it? This is Baba a little younger than when I knew him. And Shivadas pointed out to me that he's sitting in the Bhagwan Nityananda chair. And you know, this is definitely in the ashram. But I never saw that a chair like that in the ashram, so I don't. There's a story there which I can't tell. But Baba's in his 50s probably in this picture. And this is just before all the Westerners came. Another one? This is the Baba from my day. And this is Indian Baba. When we in India, because this he'd be without his shirt and so on. But in the West, he dressed like a gentleman, he would say. And he also had very very wild beard when we were in India and very, you know, what is it? Neat and pukka in the West. Next. This also, Baba, about my period there in India. Yep. And finally, this is the last one. Later on, after more people came, of course, it started, you know, everyone remembers the good old days. That is, when you came. And it was always the days when it was small. Because when I was there, when I got there, it already was big for some of the people who'd been there in the good old days when there was just Bob and 3 people. But, you know, later on, after my time, there'd be 1,000 people living in the ashram, sometimes 2,000, 3,000. And so It just kept growing because Baba's Shakti kept spreading everywhere. His reputation grew. People came. They knew that there was this powerful master living there, and they came from all over the world to see him. And we did question answers, couldn't fit in his room after a while. So we did him out in the courtyard, and he would answer from his perch. This was Ashram Mission Control. Behind that little door was his apartment. That's where he lived. He would crouch over to go through that little door, and at prescribed hours every day, he'd come out through that door and sit on his perch there and meet people. And people would just sit there and meditate in his presence. So that's the Baba I know. That was his around the early 70s. Okay. Question answer with Baba. This is 1973, November of 73. Question, Uma. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we had a wonderful session here with Chandra, who used to be the cook on Baba's tours. And we had, those of you who were here know that we had just the most fabulous time. She told great stories of cooking with Baba. You know, they were preparing meals for thousands of people three times a day. And Baba would come in the kitchen and cook with them, and it was quite extraordinary. What was one of the stories where he would test her by he'd be making a dish, and then he'd throw in a ton of what?
Salt.
A big pile of salt, and then he'd say, "Oh, I made a mistake." He said, "Fix it," and then he'd walk out. And he taught her how to fix it. There's a way of balancing salt and sweet and all these different things, and you bring something more. But he would do this on purpose, and then he'd walk out and leave her to fix it. But when we say Chandra, we also have to say Uma, because these were the two heavy-hitting ladies of the time. And Uma became the Baba's publisher. She's the one who collected all these writings and published them, and she was worked with him in literary matters for many years. And this is a question from Uma, she's an American woman. She says, "Is it possible for anyone to practice the asceticism or austerities which were practiced by the Vedic seers?" That's a curious question, isn't it? But, you know, in ancient times, in the Satyuga, the times of the Vedas, there were great yogis. Great yogis. They could sit and still their mind and sit for months and days and meditate powerfully. And here's what Baba says. Baba says, "You can do that tapasya today." Tapasya means, one translation is penance, but that's not right. It's spiritually transforming actions, practices. And it, tapas means heat. So there's a fire. They often talk about the fire of yoga, that if you do practice, if you say the mantra, you meditate intensely, it creates an inner fire, a psychic fire that purifies your ignorance, burns it out. So that's the metaphor, and it's actually literally true also. Not only is it a metaphor. So so we used to want to increase the heat of our yoga very often. Not that we needed to. It was pretty hot there anyway. But he says, you can do that tapasya today and the future too. What was the nature of the tapasya of the Vedic seers? Their tapasya consisted of speaking the truth, living by their own labor, doing japa, which is repeating the mantra, remembering only the Lord, and practicing self-control and discipline. So you can do this tapasya even today. You get that? You like that? That's the method. You speak the truth. That's hard sometimes, isn't it? You have to take what comes if you speak the truth. Living by their own labor, not being a burden to others. Baba would always say, don't be a burden to others. Do the mantra, remember the Lord, and lead a disciplined life, not an indulgent life. So he says, there must be many people who are already doing this tapasya. But today it's not necessary to do the same tapasya that the Vedic seers did. After all, what was the goal of the tapasya of the Vedic seers? The goal was knowledge of the self, or a vision of the Lord, or supreme bliss. In my own time, I saw many saints who had attained that state. Take the case of Sai Baba of Shirdi, who had achieved supreme bliss and realized God. His picture is up there, sitting with his leg on his knee there. Sai Baba of Shirdi was a great being who lived in the 19th and early 20th century. Then there was Nityananda Baba, Bhagwan Nityananda, who had achieved the highest state. Rangavadut was also in the same divine state. Rangavadut is in that painting back there. Who was that by, that painting?
That's
my pop, my dad, did that painting. He gave it to Baba many years ago. He says, so what Baba is saying, that the goal, that there are people even now who have achieved the goal, and Baba met quite a few in his travels in India. He says, it's not necessary that your tapasya or your discipline be the same as that of the Vedic seers. Depending on time and place, sadhana changes, discipline changes. This is a very profound point he's making. I couldn't agree more with this. What took a long period of time then may take a short period of time now. What was achieved through a hard and difficult method then may be achieved through a simple and easy method today. So the sadhana or spiritual practice has to conform to the needs of a particular time. It won't be the same across the board. It'll be adapted to a time. He says, at the end of the Dwapara Yuga, the saints held a conference and discussed a very important question. In the coming age of Kali Yuga, people will not be able to practice the same tapasya that the ancients did. So what shall we prescribe for them? So you might know a little bit about the doctrine of the Yugas. Who doesn't know about the Yugas? They were a rock band from New South Wales. No. In the classical Hindu thought, they have four ages. And there starts with a golden age, and called the Satyuga. Then the silver age, what do they call that one?
Treta
Yuga. And then the Dwapara Yuga, which is the bronze age. Is it bronze?
Yeah.
Something like that. And then the iron age, which is the Kali Yuga. And then in the first age, people were virtuous, brilliant, spiritual, everything was good. They lived a long time, everything was beautiful, there was abundance. Then the next age, it was a quarter less. They say the Vedic cow lost one leg. And then the next age, it was worse, and the fourth age, it's really everything's fallen apart, gone to hell. Which age are we in? No, we're in the golden age, baby. No, yeah, it's true. This is the Kali Yuga. And so it's saying at the onset of this fourth age of degradation, decadence, dissolution, lack of, when marriages fall apart and everything falls apart and there's a lot of enmity, a lot of war, and a lot of disease and so on, and lack of faith, that's more or less what we have. They got together. And they said, what are we going to do about this case? The sages went on thinking and debating, yet they could not arrive at a decision. They finally decided to go to the sage Vyas, who lived on the bank of the Ganges. Where's that? All the seers went to Vyasa's ashram. He was taking his noon bath in the river and was about to create a Shiva process workshop. He was making charts and doing things on his computer. But they went to see him. When Vyasa saw the seers enter his ashram, he became aware of what was happening in their minds. He took three dips in the river and said three times, "Oh Kali, I wish you all the best." May you live long because you are so good, you are so saintly, you are so noble. Oh, Kali, you know, you are the best. After blessing the Kali Yuga, Vyas came out of the river. All the seers greeted Vyas and sat around him. Vyas asked them, "What has brought all of you together here?" The great among the seers said to Vyas, "Sir, we had come to ask you a most significant question, but just a short while ago we heard you blessing the Kali Yuga, which all of us have been worrying about. We began to shudder with fear the moment the name of Kali Yuga is uttered, but you blessed it. What's the mystery behind that?" Vyas said, "The fruit that the seekers, the ascetics, obtained in the Satyuga, in the first age, the golden age, Sat is truth, the age of truth, by practicing severe austerities for thousands of years until their bodies were reduced to mere skeletons, is obtained in Kali Yuga just by chanting God's name for 24 hours. Day and night. When this is the case, why shouldn't I bless Kali Yuga? Why shouldn't I wish it well?" So this is a loophole. Vyasa always has loopholes. And even though it's a decadent age, you see, our expectations aren't high. In the Satyuga, everyone was a Brahmin, everyone was educated, everyone was powerful, everyone was spiritual. So you had to do meditation for 1,000 years to get any results. But here, nobody can do anything. Everybody's lost in delusion and desire and madness and neurosis and pathetic qualities. And so if God gets a little drop from anyone, he's so happy. He rewards you enormously, way out of proportion to what you're worth. That's true. And so it's actually a very good time to be born, according to this. All you have to do is chant the mantra. You have to just chant the mantra. It's so easy in this age. So Tukaram Maharaj says that the essence of all yajnas and fire rituals and other rituals, the essence of all austerities and other spiritual disciplines, is the divine name. The fruit that was obtained through rigorous austerities in ancient times is obtained today by chanting the divine name, because in the present age the body is short-lived, and so the means to God realization has to be easy. What can be easier than saying the mantra? You know, Hare Krishna, say Hare Ram, Hare Krishna. Or you could say Om Namah Shivaya. Whatever mantra can take you there very easily, very effortless method. Baba used to really emphasize mantra. Mantra is a great purifier of the mind. Gets rid of negative tendencies of the mind and connects you to the source, to the inner self. He says, Tukaram Maharaj says, "Is there anything in this world that one who repeats the divine name constantly cannot achieve? Is there anything that he cannot know?" Baba says, "Now it's not necessary for you to do the same tapasya that the ancients did. The nature of tapasya changes according to the age. And the greatest tapasya for the present age is ceaseless remembrance of the Lord, ceaseless repetition of his name, ceaseless chanting of his name, and becoming absorbed in this practice. The fruit of all austerities is supreme peace. And the same peace is obtained through the repetition of the divine name. The only trouble is that we do not practice it." Baba says, "We do not need the severe austerities that were practiced by the ancient seers, because the divine name encompasses all these practices." And I would say that effective self-inquiry is a method of this age. Very easy. You don't even have to say the mantra. All you have to do is be present. And everything comes. So we're very lucky to live in this decadent, horrible age. So don't complain about it. Say, "Isn't it wonderful? Everybody's screwed up." That's how I look at it. More work for me. I love it. All right. Now, you know, one of the things that I thought I'd throw in a little question, because a lot of the questions were about practice. We were very focused as a group. We were there to practice, so we were very focused on our practice and so on. But also, you know, Baba became like a big daddy to us, and, you know, he gave us guidance about diet and all kinds of things like that. So I thought I'd throw in one that's kind of cute. All right? This is from Surya, who must have been an Indian fellow. I don't remember the name. But he said, I was doing asanas, you know, yogic postures, such as halasan and paschimottasana. You know what those are? Who can demonstrate it? Let's have one of the boys demonstrate it, right?
Sure.
Who should I have?
I don't know who can do it.
Who should demonstrate?
Gangadhar.
Who? Gangadhar. Come on, where are you? Come on, Gangadhar. Come on. What? Come on. Yes, come over there. Come over there. It's all right. No. She'll know. She'll tell him. Yeah. This is Gangadhar from Nusa. Sit there. Okay. Okay, do you know what halasana is?
Halasana,
yeah.
Yeah, I think so. It's the one with the legs go to the back. Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. Okay. Okay. And paschimottasana.
Forward bend.
Forward bend.
Sitting
forward bend. Oh, paschimottasana.
Yeah. What do you call it?
Paschimottasana.
Oh, yeah. Pretty good. Pretty good from Australia. Nice. See it? Now, let me ask you. He says, I was doing asanas such as halasana and paschimottasana to be relieved from constipation. It stretches the bowel nicely. You find it stretches the bowel nicely?
Very open, yes.
Thank you. Give a hand. Thank you. It's always good to stretch the bowel, you know. He says, now that I've been initiated with Shaktipat, are these likely to prove harmful? And Baba says, no. Keep practicing these asanas. Have you overcome constipation or not? I don't know what the answer is, but he says, if it's still persisting, use Trifala powder. Trifala, you know? Well, Trifala. Who knows the Ayurveda? It's the Ayurvedic of three fruits. One is Vilva.
I think it's the melon as well.
One is Haritaki. And we have three Ayurvedic things that cures everything. This is the universal cure, this Trifala. He says, or you can take Haritaki. I used to take Haritaki all the time. They're angry little black things, and you chew on them. And they actually have a very lovely, flowing effect. If you ask me afterwards, I'll tell you how to use it. If that doesn't work, drink milk. Your constipation will go. I thought milk had the opposite effect, didn't it? What do you think? Is it good for
a constipation? It's unpasteurized. Milk from the cow is different than milk from the...
I don't know. You can also get rid of it by the grace of Shakti by praying to her, it says. So that's the question now. How's that? Like that? Okay. One more? Do you want to know about the fourfold qualifications of a seeker, or what's the next one? Something about reincarnation. This is a test, you know. If you're really frivolous, you'll want to know about the seeker. Which one? Which one?
Both.
Seeker? Okay. Oh. Then no one feels. Everyone feels so happy to be here. That they don't feel like they worry about seeking now. What? It's Kali Yuga, yeah. That was very taxing to hear about tapasya. Even to hear about tapasya makes your sweat break out, you know. And so in the Kali Yuga we don't want to hear about too much of that, do we? So which one should we do? What? You, Devi Ma will decide.
Oh, no.
What did you say?
Do both.
No, which one? No, do one. All right. I think we should, no, this was the bond, the reincarnation is longer. Let's do that. We'll be frivolous. Chandra, speaking of Chandra, here she is. This is Chandra, who you met on the Skype, okay? She says, when we die, is there a possibility we may be reborn on Mars or Venus? Or some other planet? Or do we always reincarnate on the Earth until we are liberated? Huh? Wow. Baba says, after one dies, one is reborn in the place where he died. You are not born on any planet or star. The only place for rebirth is the Earth. The only other world where you could be reborn is the world of ancestors. If you're not reborn in Pitraloka, the world of ancestors, then you may return in the opposite world, which is hell. But no matter which world you're born in, after your visa has expired, you have to return to this planet. They call it the Karma Bhumi, this Earth, because this is mission control in the universe. This is the place where spirit and matter meet, and that's where the real yoga goes on. There has to be that, you know, we talked about in the course, I talked about the three forces. There has to be that play of first force or your desire with meeting indifferent matter. That creates the tension in life. So you have to be positioned in a material universe to really grow spiritually. It creates the conditions, the contrast that force us to grow. Baba says, however, one who performs good deeds is reborn over and over in this very world, and each time his birth is in a higher place. It is for this reason that the Gita and other scriptures urge us to perform good deeds, because as a result of them, we'll be born into a good family again and again. As one's good deeds multiply, and as one is reborn in a higher and higher environment, which means an environment conducive to spiritual growth, there comes a day when one becomes completely free from desire and obtains liberation. One should think about how many times he's going to die and be reborn. What's the point of being reborn over and over? Regardless of how many times you were born, you have to eat the same food. You have the same body in which there are 9 exits for waste matter. The same body which is nothing but a shit manufacturing factory. Baba says, this phrase was used by the teacher who taught me Vedanta. Baba used to use that phrase a lot. He'd say, you're just a shit factory. Say, what is a person but a shit factory? They put food in one end, shit comes out the other end. You know, you take a factory, they put something in one end, something comes out the other. This is what a human being is. This keeps us humble. So he would say that. He said, just as there are mills manufacturing other things, the body is a shit factory. And when you become aware of this, you begin to long for liberation. What's the A statement there? He's saying, really, what's it all about? You know, what's it all about? Normal, mundane life, what's it all about? Go deeper. Go deeper. Go deeper. This longing turns your attention to the Lord, and then you become liberated. No matter which, you know, and that's interesting, you know, because I think, you turn your attention to the Lord, then you become liberated. Excuse me, there's a little gap between, you know, you first enter the spiritual path, because I always just think, God, it's so hard, the spiritual path. But from Baba's perspective, the moment where you turn towards the spiritual path, it's a very short period until you complete the spiritual path. If you look at it against the background of countless lifetimes, that period is very short indeed. Once we get on purpose, once we go from strength to strength spiritually, you move in that direction. Even if there's inadvertence and we lose the thread and we forget and we wander away and we get lost in something, and this happens all the time. People go and they wander off and they come back. On the darshan line, I see them, I say, oh, yeah, I haven't seen you in a while. Where you been? I don't know. What happened? But even so, that inner force is leading us towards the goal, and it grows and grows. And sometimes you don't even want it to happen. You know, you want to keep it down so you can enjoy life, but it keeps coming up. He says, no matter which form of life you may be reborn in, the place where you're going to get liberation is this very world. Therefore, you should remember the Lord intensely, because there is power in remembrance. If you don't like the word Lord, then remember the self. Remember consciousness. It's all the same thing. Remember the Guru. All these things are one. Remember that higher power. Remember your own higher power. Your own true self. He says, you become like the one you remember. And you should get rid of the memory of sins, of wickedness, of bad deeds. Don't brood about the past, past insults, past failures. You know, it's really true that what we think about, we become. Our whole life is nothing but the product of what we're thinking about. And so if we can move our thoughts higher, become less dense, higher, more light, we expand also. He says, you should meditate intensely, you should chant intensely, you should think highly of yourself, and you should charge your body more and more by the power of meditation, by the fire of meditation. You shouldn't burn it in the fire of jealousy. So burn it in the fire of shakti, energy, spiritual energy, and not in the fire of jealousy and regret. By chanting the Lord's name, one becomes the Lord himself very soon. Therefore, and Baba said his usual ending, meditate on yourself, honor and worship your own self, kneel to your own self, and see the Lord who is hidden in your own heart. So I don't think we can go to another one after that. I promise you that we'll do that other one. What was the other one on?
Sika.
That was inspiring. Yeah. So meditate on yourself and remember the Lord. It's so easy. It's funny, it's paradoxical, because it's so easy to forget about the self. We get so caught in the glitter of externals, you know, the TV and the entertainment and relationships and pleasure and all that stuff. It's so easy to get caught in that. And yet, on the other hand, it's impossible to forget, because inside of us there is a yearning, a spiritual yearning, craving. That is our true nature, that wants to be expressed, it wants to be fulfilled. No matter how you deny it or push it down, it comes up. And so, get on its side, become one with it, let it unfold, because that's the highest thing in us, is to follow that impulse and become everything that we can be. So let's meditate. Baba ended with his statement, so I'd like to do it. I got an opportunity in Hindi. He would say, he would say, apka dyao, apka pujo, apka vando, apka sanmana karo, ap mehi, apka ram, ap hoka rahata hai, which means meditate on yourself. Let's do that. We'll do it for 10 minutes. Meditate on yourself. Worship yourself. I mean worship yourself. Say to yourself, you are divine. Find yourself. Honor yourself. For God's sakes, instead of attacking yourself, honor yourself. We get into this wrong groove of putting ourselves down. Nothing is more harmful to our psyche than self-hatred, tearing thoughts. He says, God dwells within you as you. Your true essence is not different from the divine. So let's meditate for 10 minutes, and Glenn will play sitar while we meditate.